Welcome to Foreign Office. I'm Michael Weiss, Director of Special Investigations for the Free Russia Foundation. This week, we're joined by Marcy Wheeler. She is an independent journalist who spent many years covering national security and civil liberties. And she has one of the most intriguing, I guess you could call it a legal blog, Empty Wheel, which has pored over everything from the Mueller report to the Senate subcommittee intelligence report on the Russian intervention to indeed the case against Julian Assange in the UK, which is why I've asked Marcy to come on, because I can think of no better observer of this case with a legal mind than she. Marcy, thanks for being with us this week.
Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to pick your brain because you have what I would call a kind of heterodox appraisal of the case against Julian Assange. You haven't completely categorically dismissed it and said that this is some kind of witch hunt or frivolous prosecution by the United States. But you have concerns about the dangers posed to civil liberties and the First Amendment by at least some of the counts or charges against Assange. First, let's start with what the UK court decided. They obviously denied Washington's extradition request, but they did so on mental health grounds, right? I mean, they said that Julian Assange might commit suicide in American custody. Therefore, the extradition request was denied. But they didn't completely dismiss or even diminish or undermine the U.S. government's case against him. Talk a little bit about the judge's reasoning in her decision.
Let me first take a step back and describe what the charges are.
Sure.
There are 18 charges against Assange. Three of those are for publishing the identities of coalition, so U.S., British, Australian, et cetera, coalition forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and generally U.S. foreign policy. So those three are for the act of publishing. And the U.S. government is arguing that Assange released informants frivolously or recklessly and endangered these informants of the U.S. government and their allies. And that's the one that people rightly point to as criminalization of actual publication.
Right.
There are 14 other charges that are also under the Espionage Act that basically charge Assange for abetting Chelsea Manning's 2009-2010 leaks of a bunch of DOD files to WikiLeaks. These are not a lot of WikiLeaks supporters always talks about the video of Reuters journalists being shot. These all post-date that, and they're all large databases. And the theory that the government was using is Assange wasn't getting Manning, was first of all coaxing Manning to do this, but also wasn't asking Manning to leak discrete information, but was instead asking Manning to leak entire databases. Those are also publishing related offenses. People argue, I think correctly, that they charge somebody for the act of publishing, and the Espionage Act is troubling in the United States in general. So those are the 17 charges that most people talk about. The remaining one is a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, so hacking. It was the initial charge against Assange, and at that point it was very narrow. It was that Assange tried to help Manning crack a password. The government alleges that Manning might have used it to hide her tracks as she was stealing other things. I think it's possible that there was another purpose for it, but in any case, that's what it started as. In June, the government superseded it and added a bunch more hacking, and including hacks in Iceland that involve other people in the WikiLeaks world. It involves the Stratfor hacks. So a bunch of LulzSec hackers hacked the US security firm Stratfor.
Right, I remember that.
And the government alleges that Assange was involved in the front end and the back end, agreed to enter in a conspiracy. Six people have already pled guilty to that conspiracy. So that's actually a slam dunk as far as conspiracy law goes. Another one of the allegations is that WikiLeaks helped Edward Snowden flee to Russia or flee from Hong Kong and then bragged about it and used it as part of its recruitment effort for more hackers. And then a third of the allegations, and there are more, but a third of the allegations is that WikiLeaks Assange asked a WikiLeaks associate to hack a dissident who had left WikiLeaks in a snuff. That I think is important because I've heard at least one other allegation of that, and it's basically Assange just maliciously hacking people who are opposed to them.
Right.
So that is a broad-ranging hacking conspiracy charge. And virtually all of WikiLeaks supporters don't want to address the range of it and certainly don't want to address the individual allegations one by one.
Right. I mean, I remember when the initial indictment came down on that very narrow charge of computer intrusion or hacking the Pentagon, you still had people coming out and saying, well, you know, look, Chelsea Manning already had access to the system. So he was just trying to help her crack the password of another user to the system. So in other words, what he was alleged to have been doing would not have gained him access to things he didn't already have. It was just to kind of cover his tracks. And so people were arguing that this was some kind of ambiguous terrain for journalism where all he was doing was essentially trying to protect his source. But, you know, if you or I, whatever the source we had, we're reporting on, went beyond being a recipient of information and went so far as to connive to the exfiltration of that information when it involves going into government computers, a crime, I would argue that's overstepping the lines of journalism, however kind of willy-nilly or unethical you may choose to define it, and entering into illegal criminal territory, right? And so now you describe, well, hang on, he's been accused of hacking even in more system and all around the world. And as you pointed out, appears to have done so malevolently to go after his detractors. I don't see a First Amendment free speech or civil liberties case to be made in that respect. And you're saying that his defense or his supporters anyway, try to elide these allegations and focus mainly on the publication of US state secrets, which I think you and I both agree, there's nothing criminal about that. I mean, that is proper journalism.
Right. And the important thing about even that original password cracking thing is people want to talk about the practicality of, oh, could it have worked? Did it work? But that's not the way conspiracy law works in the United States, or as Judge Barrister said, even in the UK. If you enter into a conspiracy and take overt acts to forward the conspiracy, regardless of whether you're successful, then you are guilty of engaging in that conspiracy. And so whether or not, you know, however you spin it, it's still charged as a conspiracy. And that was one where the judge sort of said, well, this is a slam dunk under conspiracy law. So, you know, even the original claims were not very convincing from a legal standpoint, but that's not how this case has been argued. This has been argued in the press. It has been argued by people who don't care about how criminal law works and frankly don't care about what the extradition law is and what the range, you know, how much leeway Judge Barrister had to accept or deny the extradition. And so I think that's one of the things that has made this, the coverage of the actual extradition hearing, really problematic, because it's not been about the law. It's been about some propaganda. And some of it was outright dishonest propaganda coming from the WikiLeaks people. And, you know, the government, the US government's position was they didn't have to prove Assange guilty to get extradition. And this is something Judge Barrister said several times in her order. They only had to prove it was a fair case.
Yeah.
All of the issues that WikiLeaks people wanted to litigate in this trial would wait until he arrived in EDVA in Alexandria to be tried. They sort of are assuming that the US government provided their best evidence to prove the case. And it's virtually certain that they have a bunch of other evidence in their pocket that they're not going to share unless they know that he's actually on US territory and that they're going to get to try him.
Well, I mean, it stands to reason, and I don't know if this has actually been reported, but all of his belongings from the Ecuadorian embassy, his computers, his hard drives, whatever devices he may have had, I would imagine, given the cooperation of the Ecuadorian government with the US government, at least in recent years, are now in the custody of DOJ, right? I mean, so they probably have access to physical devices belonging to Julian Assange, which they have, I would imagine, made the best effort to try and decrypt or gain full awareness of. It sort of beggars belief that the federal government is not sitting on more information and intelligence and evidence against him than they've...
They actually said as much in the hearing. I mean, the Assange people were like, oh my God, they took all of his computers. And, you know, everyone who follows criminal cases were like, yeah. I mean, the argument for Julian Assange the people were making was, how dare this dissident be treated like a criminal? And everyone involved in the legal side of it was saying, he's an accused criminal one way or another, and he's being treated like other criminals, like it or not. For example, the Assange defendants were like, well, they took all of his computers, and the lawyer for the United States said, yeah, and it went through a taint team, and nothing from any of the lawyers actually involved in this case or anything that was actually really privileged would get to the prosecutor. So that actually was a key discussion during the extradition hearing.
It's kind of ironic to me that the reason that he repaired to the Ecuadorian embassy and spent, what, 5-6 years holed up there was the sexual assault allegations in Sweden leveled against him. And the fear was, at least as mouthed by him and his supporters, well, the UK court system, they just rubber stamp these extradition requests to the United States. And this is all a big CIA plot or stratagem to have him brought to the US and charged with all manner of crimes. Well, here you have evidence. I mean, UK judges don't simply nod affirmingly to whatever Uncle Sam has asked of them, whatever the nature of our relationship with Britain is. Talk a little, if you can, about the mental health judgment, because this doesn't quite vindicate the WikiLeaks side of the argument and the Assange boosters. And in fact, you've seen a lot of people saying, well, this was all just a pretext because the judge knew how ridiculous the US case against Assange was. She didn't want to call them out on the specifics, so instead went for this kind of namby-pamby mental health. He might be suicidal if he's brought to US custody. What are the grounds for him being suicidal? Did he say in the trial or the court hearing that he might commit suicide if he's held by the Americans? I mean, he seemed to mount a fairly vigorous and intelligible defense for himself, but she took seriously these claims that he's been psychically degraded and he's gone through all kinds of emotional torment being in British custody. So talk a little bit about that or her logic there.
Sure. And this follows on. There are two prior cases where people who are on the autism spectrum were also not extradited to the United States. The most recent is a guy named Larry Love, who has ties to Anonymous. And he, I've met him, he's a really sweet guy. He is very obviously on the autism spectrum. And he, from very early on, you know, argued that if he was put in high security prison in the United States, he would become suicidal. And that argument did not succeed at the initial level, but did succeed on appeal. And he's now wandering around free in the UK and has, you know, finished college and stuff like that. In Assange's case, it was something that came later in the process, really only in the last, say, 6 months that I know of, that they added these arguments that being in prison has made him depressed. His family has a history of suicidal tendencies and depression. He is on the spectrum, though nowhere near what Larry Love is. And those things together, and they presented a number of expert witnesses, those things together mean that being put in SHU or in SAMS, you know, non-communicative, they argue that it is the equivalent of solitary confinement, argue credibly that the US treatment of people like of national security defendants like Julian Assange means that they spend most of every day alone without a lot of contact with their family or lawyers. And that's what the judge ultimately argued is, she said the claims that he would try and commit suicide in the United States are credible. He has availed himself of some suicide prevention within, well, he's been at Belmarsh. They found in a search, they one day found part of a razor in his cabinet. And she argued, look, in Belmarsh, he's got more frequent contact with his lawyers. He's seeing his family several times a week at least. And he has more communication with people generally in the United States, in the conditions that he would be expected to be held in the United States, he wouldn't have those things. And therefore that raises the likelihood that he would try and succeed at committing suicide intolerably. And therefore she denied the extradition on those grounds. And I mean, I walked into the hearings believing, knowing actually, because I have got still close enough ties to these people, to people associated with WikiLeaks to know that this was in the offing. And I knew then that it was the most likely chance he had to avoid extradition. And because Barrister, the judge, refused extradition at this initial level, it really raises the likelihood that the US is going to fail on appeal, because she's the fact, as in the United States, in the district court, that's the fact finder. That is the judge that has listened to the witness testimony. And since she ruled for Assange on that level, it's going to be far less likely that the US succeeds on appeal than the reverse, which is what happened with Larry Love, where he lost on the first round and won on appeal.
So, and the present state is Assange's request for bail was denied. So he's still in Belmarsh under conditions that Judge Barrister seems to think are preferable to those of, you know, in the United States. And the government has the right and has exercised its right of appeal. How much longer will Julian Assange have to be in a UK prison until the government's appeal is adjudicated? Do we have a time frame on that? Is it weeks? Is it months?
The US government has to formally appeal 14 days from the decision. So it's actually before the end of the Trump term.
Okay.
And then it could take months at the next level to hear the appeal. So not years. You know, there are a couple of other levels of appeal depending on what happens. Assange could also appeal to the EU on humanitarian grounds. So it's unclear how long he will remain in Belmarsh. I would guess 2 months at least.
Yeah.
2 months from now, at least.
Look, Assange pops up everywhere in the last 3, 4, or 5 years. I mean, he's in the Mueller report. I believe he's in the Senate subcommittee intelligence report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. And, you know, one of the burning questions, at least for myself, and I've spent years querying Western intelligence officials about this, what is Julian Assange's relationship with the Russian government, right? It's all well and good to kind of monitor the WikiLeaks Twitter feed, which up until his incarceration, he was manning, and say, right, I mean, this is somebody whose interests, whose avowed worldview seems to conform pretty neatly with that of the Kremlin. And then all of these attempts, these conspiracy theories about the Seth Rich murder and where the information from the DNC and DCCC and Podesta emails actually came from, the source obfuscation he engaged in collaboration with pro-Trump elements in the US media, such as Sean Hannity. It raised all these questions of, is there some kind of conspiracy between Assange and therefore WikiLeaks and a Russian intelligence service? What is your appraisal of that? I'm sure you've forgotten more about stuff that's come to light recently against Assange than most people will ever know. So is there evidence to suggest that there is such a relationship?
You mentioned that he shows up in the CISI report. He actually shows up in several of the CISI, the Senate Intelligence Committee reports, because remember, they've done 5 volumes on the Russian investigation.
Right.
And virtually all of that is redacted, which means it's sensitive from an intelligence standpoint, still ongoing in criminal investigations. There are, however, a few places where you can see an argument that as the attack started in 2016, as the hack and leak operation started in 2016, there were a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who were arguing Julian Assange is a publisher. We can't investigate him aggressively. You know, he's just taking these files and publishing them. And then through the course of that investigation, and remember, so you mentioned that he was investigated by Mueller. He was investigated for things that aren't exclusively journalism by Mueller. He was investigated for an illegal foreign campaign donation, among other things. He also, during this period, published, starting on March 7th, 2017, basically the CIA's hacking tools. He started by publishing their development notes. Over the course between then and November of 2017, he released 2 sets of source files. So he basically was exposing the CIA's hacking program. The government alleged in a trial of the person they accused of doing that, a guy named Josh Schulte, who was one of the developers, they accused him of leaking those files in April of 2016, April to May of 2016. So in other words, Julian Assange sat on the CIA's hacking tools from sometime in May of 2016 until March of 2017, incidentally, trying to coerce immunity in discussions with DOJ about them starting in February of 2017, just as the Russian investigation started. For that investigation, there's no reason to believe they targeted Assange. There is a lot of reason to believe that he remained in contact with Schulte. And so even just in investigating Schulte, they would have been monitoring communications between Assange and Schulte. And also trying, what didn't get released are the vast majority of the source code for the CIA's hacking tools. So Julian Assange and his allies are all sitting on the source code for all of CIA's hacking tools circa 2017. And that was a period when WikiLeaks servers were stored in Russia.
Right.
So that was another reason they were investigating him. And then the third was as a counterintelligence target because of his cooperation with GRU, Russian intelligence, during the 2016 operation. So there were three new prongs of investigation of Assange. And the language of CISI says that they, in bipartisan fashion, now believe that the WikiLeaks operation was co-opted by Russian intelligence. We don't know when, we don't know how far back, we don't know to what degree, but it is, according to CISI, WikiLeaks somewhere along the line got co-opted by Russian intelligence. One of the prosecutors in the case, when he was trying to push Jeremy Hammond, the admitted Stratfor hackers who did his time, he was subpoenaed by a grand jury. And as the prosecutor was trying to push him to testify, he said, you know, look, Julian Assange is just a Russian spy. That's not an official view of the U.S. government, but it did come from one of the prosecutors in this case.
Right. And famously, you had Mike Pompeo, when he was CIA director, say, you know, if it looks like a hostile intelligence agency, or, you know, it is something along those lines, which was a rather stark statement coming from the active CIA director. I mean, in other words, you know, there's no real room for doubt or ambiguity. According to our assessment is that he is working on behalf of a hostile foreign power and its security services.
Right. And one of the things to think about is, I mean, that came a month after the initial release of the CIA hacking tools. One of the things that WikiLeaks did in the publication of the CIA hacking tools was leave the names of the guy who allegedly leaked them, Joshua Schulte, did so because he just wanted to burn the CIA to the ground. He really had no whistleblower purpose in doing this.
Right.
He was pissed at his colleagues. WikiLeaks left the names of the other developers who might have been the culprit for the leak available in the initial publication. So I don't know whether they left the pseudonyms or the actual names. I think they were the pseudonyms, but in any case, those were protected CIA identities. And then by identifying even just the development notes, foreign intelligence services would have been able to find tools. And if, say, somebody in their office was holding that tool or their computer had been compromised by that tool, that would have been a pretty good way of tagging who CIA's assets were. And so, you know, now that I've followed the trial really closely, that is, I think, the reason Pompeo said that. He raised past operations, Philip Agee, where people leaked CIA identities. And that's an accusation he made about WikiLeaks in April 2017. And I think that's why he did so, because by releasing these files and or storing them in Russia starting in September of 2016, he effectively gave foreign intelligence services, probably especially Russia, the ability to identify how the CIA had compromised them via hacking.
Right. And that's not negligence coming from somebody with the operational security savvy of Julian Assange, right? It stands to reason he gave them access, or he allowed them to access it, because he is a witting accomplice, or he has some kind of working relationship with them. I mean, the Agee case is interesting too, because, you know, for the longest time, decades, in fact, people who were supporters of him, because they saw what he was doing as kind of God's work, exposing the, you know, corrupt and illegal activities of the CIA abroad. But then it came to light after the Cold War. In fact, the KGB was running Phil Agee, and they were publishing his covert action bulletin. And so there was a working relationship there. Do you think that in any kind of future indictments of Assange, whether by the U.S. government or, I mean, you've alluded to the fact that, you know, the stuff he was doing was burning coalition partners. So, I mean, this is somebody who could fall afoul of the law in the UK, where he's now confined. Do you think that, I mean, if you had to guess, that some of this stuff will come to light at some kind of public forum or trial in future, namely what Western governments have in terms of intelligence on Assange not being this transparency advocate and journalist as he proclaims he is, but actually somebody who is at minimum an agent of influence of the Russian government?
I think it could come out in one of two ways. And one is in similar cases in the past where both countries wanted to deal with a national security threat. I could see the U.S. asking the U.K. to prosecute Assange if they believe that he won't be extradited. And yes, even the initial Chelsea Manning files, the allegation is that Assange willingly released the identities of coalition partners, so including U.K. partners. The Vault 7 stuff, we've just talked about how in publishing them, he released the identities of some CIA officers and probably some CIA assets. And so that might be the basis that the UK could prosecute him. And I think the UK would need it to be something like that, because political opinion in the UK has changed so much to support Assange because of this extradition. We talked about the CFAA charge going up through Snowden. Basically, they bring it through 2015. And I expected for years that eventually you would see conspiracy, including other people besides Assange, you would see a conspiracy coming up through at least the Vault 7 leaks, because that's where the Vault 7 leaks and Assange's involvement in the Russian hack and leak operation in 2016 are where, as I said, the US government's opinion of Assange dramatically changed. Whether or not they lose this extradition battle, I could see them doing this omnibus indictment after Trump loses office. Incidentally, there's this part of the Mueller investigation, which I seem to be the only one who likes to write about, but Assange was investigated from the start for his discussions about a pardon through Roger Stone with Donald Trump. So there's this moment, for example, in June of 2017, where Stone says to Assange himself in DM, and he says, "You know, I'm talking to the highest level of government about trying to deal with your issues." And it's after that, it's like within 2 weeks after that, where Trump orders Corey Lewandowski to shut down all investigation of past Russian hack and leak operations. So Roger Stone asks, tells Assange that he's asked, and Trump tries to, through Corey Lewandowski, to shut down any investigation that would implicate Assange. So it's very easy to show that there were actions taken. According to the 302s that have been released in FOIA, there's good reason to believe that that discussion, a discussion for a pardon that started, we know it started at least by November 15th, 2016. There's a lot of reason to believe it started before the Podesta files came out. That investigation was, at least if we can believe the FOIA releases, that investigation was ongoing as recently as October. So if you imagine this big omnibus indictment that includes Assange, it may also include Donald Trump. Assange's boosters are really pushing hard for a Trump pardon, but I pointed out to them, they either don't believe me or they don't want to hear it from me. But if Trump were to pardon Assange, it would be one of the legally most suspect pardons he could do short of his own self-pardon, because there's evidence that those discussions started even before he became president and possibly before he was even elected and possibly in some kind of quid pro quo for the Podesta release in October of 2016. And so we may see a story like that come out in the near future. And that can come out whether or not Assange is extradited. It can come out, you charge Assange in it and charge other people, and then you get to tell the story one way or another, whether you can extradite him or not.
Right. So filing a criminal complaint as a way of kind of ventilating the dirty laundry and then letting journalists kind of take it from there, even though you know you can't get him back. WikiLeaks, though, has form. I mean, when we talk about leaving source code or metadata that can be used to identify CIA agents or assets in the field, I mean, a lot of people would hear that and say, well, so what? You know, I mean, there are plenty of people who want to burn the CIA to the ground because they think of it as a venal and criminal organization. But WikiLeaks has released information before where they refuse to redact sensitive or compromising material. There's the famous case of, I think, the Afghan informants, right? And then according to The Guardian, journalists who were working with Assange in releasing those State Department cables, you know, Assange was of the opinion they're informants for the US government. Fuck them, right? We don't care about that. Then there was the release of, I believe it was thousands of Turkish nationals identifying materials, whether it was like phone numbers or credit card numbers. This is not an organization that seems to care very much about protecting innocent parties in pursuit of its total transparency agenda. And I wonder, I mean, if we're talking about when might a co-optation have taken place versus, well, look, he does not behave as a journalist. Journalists are at least bound by some ethical covenant of don't cause harm to people who don't deserve it in pursuit of what is in the public interest. You know the WikiLeaks people better than a lot of us do. I mean, what is your kind of assessment there? What is the logic behind releasing everything, and even if it's going to lead to people being kidnapped or murdered or thrown into prison in illiberal, non-democratic countries such as Belarus, where the allegation, as you know, was that Assange's friend and confidant, Israel Shamir, a Russian national, basically gave the Lukashenko regime all of the State Department cables, noting who U.S. diplomats in Belarus were meeting with from the Belarusian opposition. Why do they do this? What is their rationale or their logic for doing, for behaving this way as a purported news organization?
I'm not sure. I just want to specify so people know that allegedly happened in 2011. That happened in the same time frame, 2010, 2011. It happened with the Chelsea Manning leaks. And so, you know, I reported on the Chelsea Manning leaks like a lot of other journalists, and there's a lot that was really valuable there. I would hate to imagine that if Assange was co-opted by Russia, he was already co-opted then, but that is one piece of evidence that people have pointed to say, this was when WikiLeaks started obtaining entire databases, and the Israel Shamir moment is one where there was the first question where whether WikiLeaks was taking information they got and either selling it or sharing it with people. There's another allegation from the Syria leaks from 2012, where some of the most damning files, some of the files that would be most damning to Russia, never got published. And that's particularly damning because I know for a fact that there were two or three different channels by which those files got to Assange. And yet with all those channels, the ones that were damning to Russia somehow never got published. And I think one of the most interesting and important views on this, I think Zeynep Tufekci, who wrote a lot about the Turkish case, right? Because that's where she's from. She argued during the Hunter Biden stuff last fall that what we're really talking about with the release of all of these identities is blackmail. The reason why having an entire laptop from Hunter Biden is damaging is because it's blackmail, and you don't even have to verify that the information coming out of it is true. You just hang it over somebody's head. Same with the Saudis, same with the Turks, same with, I mean, you know, the Podesta files, the DNC files, there were a lot of people, a lot of private individuals in there who had their lives exposed. And it's a way to make even individuals within the organization easy to compromise or easy to embarrass. And I think if, you know, if you believe the worst of WikiLeaks, I think that that is the explanation. If you believe the argument I think Assange would make or would make circa 2006, is that you do this to make large bureaucracies dysfunctional. You do this to make them paranoid, and in making them paranoid, you make them collapse on their own weight. Those are not mutually exclusive issues, but I think that that's the explanation that Julian Assange circa 2006 would give.
Yeah. You know, I followed a number of his former associates and collaborators, Jenny Jardin, who is a reporter at Boing Boing, who says, like, looking back, there was some weird stuff going on dealing with this. This wasn't through WikiLeaks. This was through the, you know, that the kind of free speech electronic forum that
Freedom of the Press Foundation. Yeah,
exactly. Where, you know, I mean, he was trafficking in anti-Semitic tropes in his rhetoric. You know, questions were put to other members of the organization. Do you think that Julian is working for the Russians? And the response was crickets. So not very transparent behavior for somebody, you know, portraying themselves on the world stage as being about total transparency. I mean, again, we don't have access to what the U.S. government and other Western intelligence services have access to. But, you know, it is strange. I kept hearing for a long time from a lot of credible people in counterintelligence, well, you know, look, I mean, he's a megalomaniac. He's a narcissist, has a lot of in common with Donald Trump in terms of personality disorders. And people like that, frankly, don't necessarily need to be co-opted by the Russians to do their bidding. I mean, they have a vested interest in just kind of tearing down the United States or tearing down the West. And so it is this kind of nebulous area. And as you pointed out, I mean, casually using the word spy doesn't really mean anything if it's a prosecutor saying it. There are so many different sort of gradations for what a relationship with, whether it's the SVR or the GRU, might look like. I mean, it could be an agent of influence, right? Which I would argue anyone who is communicating with the Russian services and receiving information with a fairly good awareness that that's where it's coming from would definitionally have to be. You know, we've kind of talked about I think, most of this guy's CV. How do you think this is all going to play out? Do you think in 2 months' time he walks out of Belmarsh a free man and then, I don't know, moves back to Iceland, or does he go to Russia? I mean, what is the future for Julian Assange hold, in your view?
I've said that I think it's unlikely that the U.S. appeal will succeed, but I don't know whether the UK would be willing to charge him. By the way, that, you know, there are other charges that are further removed from journalism. I mentioned that he basically was using the Vault 7, the CIA hacking tools, to effectively extort immunity out of the United States. That's not journalism either. And I could see the UK maybe seeing fit to charge him on those grounds. So that's one thing that could happen. As I said, there could be this omnibus indictment that, well, it wouldn't change his legal exposure in the UK. It might change how people feel about him. For him to move from the UK to either Australia or Mexico, which has offered him asylum, or Russia, he'd have to get there safely with a red notice out for his arrest. So we'll see whether that happens. You know, the other question is, assuming that he is out free somewhere, I can't imagine that he would survive long in Mexico, only because his survival would be entirely dependent on AMLO, on the existing president. You know, who knows what the next regime would want to do? And who knows how much a Biden regime could pressure Mexico. The same thing in Australia. I mean, I think that you could see his survival in Australia change at any given moment, particularly if this different picture of him comes out. And I think people close to him recognize that he's still at legal exposure, regardless of where he is. And the U.S. is not going to drop charges, so he will have limited movement. And the United States, as we saw with Ecuador, is going to pressure whatever government gives him some kind of sanctuary moving forward, especially if he continues to publish.
And particularly if he's using that sanctuary to carry on with his past behavior of leaking, compromising, and damaging information about the U.S. and its allies. I mean, that's essentially what turned the tide with Ecuador. Ecuador didn't want to take ownership of this. This was happening in their own embassy. It's fascinating. And it's also kind of intriguing to me to see the kind of media narrative sort of been like a sine curve, right? I mean, he was a hero for publishing. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, a lot of the stuff early days, what WikiLeaks was putting out, I would argue was in the public interest. I mean, we should know about American war crimes in Afghanistan. That's any credible journalist would want to report a story like that. But the kind of waning celebrity, and now it seems that in the UK, public opinion is sort of, if not pro-Assange, then anti-Assange, because nobody likes the U.S. government under this administration. And they see this as, even though it we can argue it was not, as a kind of form of prosecutorial persecution of somebody, a dissident, a whistleblower, albeit one who stands accused of multiple counts of computer fraud and hacking. Well, look, Marcy, I mean, it's been really edifying having you on, as I knew it would be. And it would be great to get you back on when we know what the next development is in the Assange saga, whether it's extradition request denial being upheld by the UK court or overturned, or if indeed there are new indictments that come down the pike by the Americans or the British. So I do hope you'll come back and walk us through it when and if that happens.
Absolutely.
Cool. You've been listening to Foreign Office. I'm Michael Weiss, and my guest this week was Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who's focused on national security and civil liberties. And we've been talking about the case of the United States versus Julian Assange. Thanks for joining us.